could have been in harm's way. The Secret Service whisked away Vice President Johnson's daughters, and the daughters of Kennedy appointees were called into the headmistress's office to be reassured. President Kennedy's death shattered my world. My father, indeed everyone I knew, was inspired by the president's ideals, his energy, and his ability to attract exceptional talent. His assassination was a crushing blow, especially after such a heady period of optimism and hope. My father continued to head the FAA under the new president, Lyndon Johnson, who had many good qualities. I especially admired his ardent defense of civil rights and his commitment to wage the war against poverty. But his forcefulness was less appealing when he consistently rebuffed my father's many requests to return to the private sector. My father finally prevailed and moved us to New York in 1965. Heavily in debt after 4 years at the FAA, he accepted an offer from Juan Trippe, the founder and CEO of Pan American World Airways, to take over Pan Am. Another new school, another new environment. I was 14 and miserable. Moving to New York meant I was deprived of my treasured horseback riding. On top of all this disappointment and insecurity, my first months in the city were haunted by an unusual menace. A young man, an American university student once employed by my mother in Washington as a part-time babysitter, was harassing me with a series of disturbing letters. I was terrified. He wrote that he was watching me, that he was going to visit me and take me away. In those first months in New York, I was certain he was stalking me. I was afraid to leave the apartment building, and when I did, I felt even worse. I finally confided in my mother, who alerted the authorities. The young man was eventually institutionalized, but it would be some time before I could relax. It was around this time that I went on a classical studies tour of Greece. My Mediterranean Arab instincts surfaced in the marketplaces, where I learned the art of bargaining over every price. On my return to New York, I reflexively continued to use the same approach when making a purchase at Bloomingdale's, to the clerk's total befuddlement. It was not easy to suppress the Halabi brothers' entrepreneurial genes. In New York, my parents insisted on sending me to the one school we visited that I had said I did not want to attend, Chapin, an elite private school for girls. My mother and my father were concerned about negative peer pressure and wanted to protect me from the social upheaval of the times. I had no plans to become a flower child and run away to San Francisco, but I was increasingly vocal about my opposition to America's military involvement in Vietnam. From the beginning, Vietnam was different from other wars. It was televised, bringing the wrenching images of war into our student dormitories and people's living rooms. Also, its goals were ambiguous, offering little justification, many of us thought, for becoming involved in a civil war thousands of miles away in Southeast Asia. Americans divided quickly into two camps. Hawks, who supported military action and saw it as essential to limiting the spread of communism, and doves, who supported the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. Indeed, many students felt U.S. intervention into Vietnam's internal affairs was immoral in light of the corruption and unpopularity of the Vietnamese government. Others were protesting the draft, the use of violence against civilians, and the mounting body count of American soldiers. Yet the military buildup continued. By the end of 1965, the nearly continuous bombing raids over North Vietnam were underway, and there were more than 200,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam. It was a heady time to be young in America, but not at my school in New York. The world was held at arm's length at Chapin, with no student involvement in the debate over Vietnam or the civil rights movement, or indeed anything that smacked of dissent. Instead, there were rules and regulations about everything, starting with the school uniform. Chapin girls had only just stopped wearing gloves to school, but were still required to wear hats, And in the era of miniskirts, the skirts of our uniforms had to touch the floor when we kneeled. After the stimulating and politically charged environment my friends and I had enjoyed in Washington, Chapin felt like a straitjacket. I deeply resented my parents' unilateral decision to send me there. Nor was my independent spirit appreciated by school authorities. My election to class office was vetoed by the Chapin administration because I was considered apathetic and negligent. They might have felt I posed a threat to their well-ordered, meticulously controlled environment. Perhaps I did. Being viewed as a less-than-desirable Chapin student was a distinction I shared with a far more illustrious Chapin rebel, Jacqueline Bouvier, who had attended some 20 years earlier. To the school's credit, it offered a community service program tutoring non-English-speaking students in a public school in Harlem, and I volunteered to serve. It was a humbling experience. Initially, I was frustrated by my inability to make any meaningful progress with the students, many of whom had serious learning disabilities and needed far more support than I or anyone available to them would ever be able to provide. I eventually made some headway, but the most important lesson I took away from the experience was just how difficult it is to break the vicious cycle of ignorance and poverty. Years later, I chose to focus my senior architecture and urban planning thesis at Princeton on a community redevelopment scheme in Harlem. While I struggled at school, my father was having his own difficulties at Pan Am. Juan Tripp was very far-sighted. He was the first airline executive to add Boeing 707 and 747 jets to his fleet. But he was also grandiose. He ordered no fewer than 25 of the first 747s, which were too heavy for their engines, and approved several extravagantly expensive construction projects. Moreover, for all his promises that he would step aside and make my father CEO of the airline, Tripp continued to rule the company for another 4 years. When he finally retired, he made my father president, but handed the chairmanship of the financially strapped airline to another man. For all my father's challenges as second in command at Pan Am, there were substantial benefits to us. Since we traveled Pan Am routes for free, during holidays we went wherever Pan Am flew. Skiing was more economical for us in Austria or Switzerland, as was studying the Greek language in Greece and French in France. That part of our family life was heaven, but the tension at home was becoming more pronounced. Looking back, however, I realized that circumstances at home, my father's unrelenting perfectionism and my mother's courageous, if painful, struggle for family peace, strengthened me and taught me self-reliance. And I would draw inspiration from their dedication to public service for the rest of my life. After years of lobbying my parents to attend boarding school, I finally succeeded in attending Concord Academy in Concord, Massachusetts, for my remaining 2 years of high school. The school was one of the most academically prestigious in the country, and I had been particularly impressed in a meeting with the headmaster when he explained that students were disciplined for missing or being late to classes or meals by having to chop the wood that helped heat the dorms in winter. A healthy contrast, I thought, with Chapin's controlling atmosphere. I felt very fortunate to be at Concord Academy. My classmates were a brilliant group of strong, motivated young women. Academic life was extremely stimulating, and expectations were high. But more important to me, the school placed a high premium on individualism and personal responsibility. It was on a whim that I applied to Princeton University in my senior year at Concord. For years I had planned to return to the West Coast for university, and I particularly loved the campus at Stanford University. Princeton was debating opening its doors to women for the first time in its 222-year history, and had indicated they might consider applications for the class of 1973. My college advisor was very enthusiastic and urged me to apply. I did, for a lark. I was going to Stanford if they accepted me. Princeton, traditional and conservative, did not fit my notion of an ideal university, especially during this period of social change and political turmoil. In the hot competition for places at top-rated universities, I did not feel particularly distinguished, although I had good test scores, played several varsity sports, and was captain of my field hockey team. Compared to my talented classmates, I was unremarkable. So when my letter of acceptance arrived from Stanford, I was thrilled. I was also one of 150 women, along with my good friend and classmate Marion Freeman, whom Princeton accepted for its historic first co-ed class. I was suddenly torn. Part of me was drawn to the unprecedented Princeton challenge, but I was also longing to return to California. I agonized until the last minute of the deadline for postmarking our replies. I stood at a mailbox on a deserted New York City street, weighing my options, and finally mailed my acceptance to New Jersey, thinking I could always transfer after 2 experimental years. That fall, Princeton's first class of women arrived on campus with little sense of what to expect. We found ourselves isolated in a dormitory, Pine Hall, on the edge of the campus. We were definitely in an awkward situation. 1 woman to every 22 men. Males whose previous experience with women on campus was as weekend attractions. We were not dates. We were not made up. We were just going to class at 8 in the morning. Marion and I would room next to each other during our sophomore year and become very close friends. We remain so to this day. Unfortunately, the reserve I had acquired in nursery school to cope with my social awkwardness led to all sorts of misconceptions. One upperclassman told me that at first he had thought of me as a New York snob, while another labeled me haughty and an ice princess. It did not help that in a flurry of publicity, my father was finally named the new CEO and president of Pan Am, soon after the fall term began, further cementing my unapproachable image. One day I was confronted by a couple of upperclassmen who taunted me about my Arab background. One more reason I spent so many Saturday nights of my freshman year alone, reading in my room. In the midst of all this, my mother began calling me, desperately trying to persuade me to make my society debut in New York that winter. I found the whole idea absurd. The archaic coming-out party tradition to introduce young women to society, and thus presumably to establish their eligibility for marriage, was anathema to me. I sensed that she was being pressured by my father's continuing need to be accepted and assimilated, and by the social priorities of her own New York friends, whose daughters were no doubt being far more accommodating than I. The Vietnam War was a far greater concern to me at that time than my social eligibility. Anti-war sentiment was in full cry at college campuses across the country, and Princeton was no exception. With the body count of U.S. and Vietnamese casualties mounting daily, and a campus filled with draft-age young men, a debutante party seemed not only frivolous and embarrassing, but totally inappropriate. I could not fathom my parents' insensitivity. One day, while my mother sobbed her pleas to me over the phone, I finally relented, but declared I would attend only 1 group event. I understood that my coming-out party was not about me, but about them. A month after I started at Princeton, 250,000 people, the largest gathering yet, marched on Washington to protest the war. In solidarity, the entire campus observed Vietnam Moratorium Day and fasted while the headline of the Princetonian bannered Stop the War. The disclosure of America's secret intervention in Cambodia in the spring of 1970 triggered intense campus protests all over the country, including Kent State University, where protesting students were fired on by the Ohio National Guard. 4 were killed and 9 injured. The TV and newspaper images remain seared in my memory, especially the photograph of a young woman, Marianne Vecchio, kneeling by the dead body of a student, her arms outstretched in shock, and her face contorted by the screams anyone looking at the photograph could hear. The outrage was immediate. Violent protests against the Kent State killings erupted across America. The entire Princeton campus went on strike, and exams were canceled. During a protest at the Institute of Defense Analyses, we were tear-gassed by anti-riot police. It was a seminal moment in shaping my view of American society. While I loved my country, I found my trust in its institutions badly shaken. The war in Vietnam and the rapidity of the social and political changes sweeping the country had simply engulfed us. Many students were dropping out of school or taking leaves of absence at the time to examine and resort their priorities. I certainly did not feel I was getting as much out of university as I wanted to, and I did not want to waste the time I was there. So after 3 distracted semesters, I decided to take a year's leave of absence to clear my head. In the winter of 1971, I went to Colorado, thinking I could easily find a job to support myself in a winter resort town. I arrived during a major winter storm and woke up on the floor of a trailer where I had been offered refuge during the blizzard. My father was furious. He flew to Aspen, where I had found a job cleaning hotel rooms, to accuse me of running away. But the opposite was true. I needed time and space to set my own priorities and to discover if I could survive on my own. However disappointed my father might have been, a sentiment he expressed in no uncertain terms, I knew the sabbatical was the right thing for me. I worked as a maid, as a waitress in a pizza parlor, and as a part-time gopher at the Aspen Institute, making enough money to eat and pay my share of the rent in a house I was sharing with other young women. I attended my first institute conference on Technological Change and Social Responsibility, which featured the wisdom and expertise of the amazing inventor-architect genius Buckminster Fuller. And I worked on an innovative architectural project for an environmental school. Once again, I felt I was intellectually engaged. I went back to Princeton after a year in Colorado and elected to major in architecture and urban planning. My course of study was an eclectic one, combining history, anthropology, sociology, psychology, religion, arts, physics, and engineering. I loved it. It was a captivating, multidisciplinary approach to understanding and addressing the most basic needs of individuals and communities. Architecture studies also provided me with some very practical skills, a reduced need for sleep, and practice in thinking on my feet when faced with merciless critiques of my work. Both of these would prove very useful in later life. My father's job at Pan Am was about to end. He had lobbied the members of the Civil Aeronautics Board in Washington for a fair shake for the company, but Richard Nixon, a Republican, was president, and my father, a registered Democrat, could make no headway. Nixon's staff was so partisan that my father was even included in John Dean's White House enemies list, effectively killing any chance of federal support for Pan Am. A few months later, that paranoia would prove to be Nixon's undoing as news of the Watergate scandal broke. Mergers were a possible solution, but for various reasons, none came to fruition. There were personnel problems, issues with the board of directors, differences with the top executives, and Pan Am's mounting debt. Finally, it was over. On March 22, 1972, the board asked for and received my father's resignation. My father observed later that Alexa, Chris, and I seemed genuinely pleased that he was no longer a big business tycoon. Whether that meant they wanted to see more of me or that they were embarrassed by trying to explain away Pan Am to their friends, I do not know, he said. I cannot speak for my sister or brother, but it was clear to me that he was far less suited to the cutthroat ways of the business world than he was to his first love, public and international service. Soon after my father stepped down from Pan Am, the president of Jordan's national airline, Ali Randour, invited my parents to visit that country in the spring of 1973. Because my father seemed so tired, Randour arranged for my parents to spend a few days by the sea at the royal compound in Aqaba, and it was there that they met King Hussein. The two men hit it off immediately. The king, then 38, told my father about his plans for expanding civil aviation in Jordan, and asked him to act as an advisor. My father readily agreed. For the rest of their time in Jordan, my parents toured the ancient land's remarkable archaeological sites in the king's helicopter. During my spring break from Princeton, I heard all about my parents' trip, especially their audience with King Hussein. My mother was enchanted by him, and showed me a brooch he had given her, fashioned in the shape of a peacock and set with four small stones, sapphire, emerald, ruby, and diamond. He had chosen the different colored stones, he had told her, because he did not know whether she would be a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead. So it was my mother who first brought King Hussein into my life, and in a very appealing way. "He has," she said, "the most beautiful, kind eyes." Chapter 3. Tehran Journal. When I graduated from Princeton in 1974, I decided to take advantage of the Pan Am travel privileges extended to our family and to travel and work abroad in regions of special interest to me. I began in Australia, having been offered a job in the Sydney office of the British planning firm Llewellyn Davis. But a significant revision of the country's immigration law coincided with my arrival, and I was denied a work permit. In an amazing instance of serendipity, while considering my next steps, I happened to run into an old carpool companion from my elementary school in California one day in Sydney. She was leaving her position at another architectural firm, which had projects in the Middle East. My Arab-American background uniquely qualified me to work on these projects from their Sydney office, making me eligible for the elusive Australian work visa. After a year working in Australia, I attended an Aspen Institute symposium in Persepolis, near the ancient Persian capital of Shiraz, which was built some 2,500 years ago by King Darius the Great and finished by his son Xerxes. In Persepolis, the ruins came to life in a son et lumière show with a narrative about the accomplishments of the early Persian kings who extended the borders of the Persian Empire into Europe and India, built a canal between the Nile and the Red Sea, and a network of roads that are still being used today, and even established a postal system. The sound and light show was a beautifully effective blend of music, poetry, and imagery that sent shivers down my spine. I could never have imagined at the time that I would be involved in later efforts to achieve a similar atmospheric and powerful dramatization of history in a sound and light presentation in the Jordanian city of Jerash. At that Aspen Institute conference, I met, for the first time, Empress Faradiba of Iran, who, a few years later, would become a dear and respected friend, though at the time our two worlds could not have appeared further apart. The Shabanu hosted the final evening's banquet, held in grand tents erected 5 years earlier for the celebration honoring the 2,500th anniversary of the Persian Empire, which had been the largest gathering of heads of state in history. At the end of the conference, I was offered a fascinating opportunity to join Llewellyn Davis in Iran. The firm had been hired by the Shah, Reza Pahlavi, to build a model city center on 1,600 acres in North Tehran. Shahistan Pahlavi, town of the Shah Pahlavi, was an enormously ambitious undertaking and a personal interest of the Shah's. The project was an urban planner's fantasy. The new city center, with its views of the snow-capped Alborz mountain range, was to feature pedestrian malls, theaters, moving sidewalks, shopping galleries, shaded arcades, and terraced gardens. Government ministry buildings and foreign embassies would rim one of the largest open public spaces in the world, to be called Shah and Nation's Square. The scale was monumental. Shah and Nation Square was designed to be larger than Red Square in Moscow, and the Shah and Shah Boulevard, the broad, tree-lined avenue through the project's center, was intended to emulate the Champs-Élysées in Paris. My work as a planning assistant entailed surveying and mapping all the buildings in the vast area surrounding the site. When the Shah initiated the Model City scheme, he was inspired by Shah Abbas the Great, a Persian leader and patron of the arts in the 16th and 17th centuries. Shah Abbas had transformed Esfahan, the former capital of Persia, into one of the world's great cities, with innovative architecture and a sweeping use of space. Located in the center of Iran, it is an island of green amid the vast desert plains, with magnificent buildings, like the Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque and the Sheikh al-Sotun Palace, and graced with wide boulevards, an abundance of bridges, and lush aromatic gardens. When I think of Esfahan, I see the intricately designed blue ceramic tiles that decorate so many of its buildings, and the ubiquitous tea rooms where Iranians would sit for hours, chatting and smoking water pipes. I arrived in Tehran in the fall of 1975. There were about 20 of us working on the project, living in a cluster of apartments near the site. At 24, I was the youngest of the group and the only woman. Many of my colleagues treated me like a little sister, making brotherly attempts to sophisticate me, encouraging me to use makeup and make more of an effort with my loose, flowing hair. Iranian women living in the city, like their Arab counterparts, tended to be elaborately formal in their appearance, jewelry, and dress. I possessed neither makeup nor jewels, only the bare necessities of an easily packed working wardrobe and jeans, having always assumed that character and professional merit would serve me better than my appearance. Nonetheless, I longingly admired the striking, filmy chadors of delicately printed chiffon and other fabrics that enveloped Iranian women of all ages and backgrounds as they moved about in public. I would happily have adopted that style of dress, so intensely feminine and mysteriously modest at the same time. I loved walking in Tehran, wandering through the tangled maze of the bazaar and down Qajar Street, a pedestrian's delight of magnificent oriental carpets and wall hangings. Nearby, modern buses and automobiles vied for space with donkey carts. It was hard to describe Iran to my friends back in the United States because it defied easy categorization. Under those gossamer chadors, hip young women wore bell-bottom jeans and platform shoes. When I traveled up to the vast Shahistan Pahlavi site, I passed by the palatial homes of Tehran's new rich, but in the south of the city I could barely breathe due to air pollution from refineries situated in the middle of neighborhoods where Iran's growing number of poor people lived. The treatment of women was nuanced as well. I never felt pressured or intimidated when traveling alone or moving from one place to another, but I was often stared at strangely, especially if I went to a restaurant alone for a meal. Near the end of my stay, when most of our team had relocated to London, I would go out alone to eat quite often. Those were not easy moments. The embarrassed maitre d' did not quite know what to do when I showed up, and inevitably seated me off in an obscure corner. My journal from those days describes my feeling that the country seemed to have a split personality. On the one hand, it was very Western and cosmopolitan, with a large, well-educated middle class, and on the other, it retained an exotic Middle Eastern flavor and a dynamic folk culture. It was in Iran that I sensed with even greater intensity what had struck me in visits to Mexico and Central America in the early 1970s, the vitality of a country expressed through its handicrafts. Persian carpets are the best-known example, but it was the intricate, finely detailed paintings on lacquered wood, delicate silver boxes with fine enameling, and drawings of historic scenes that captured my imagination. I learned that the Shah's wife, Empress Farah, had supported the handicrafts industry as a way of raising the living standards of the poor. Years later, I would recall the Shabanu's success when I initiated a project to revive and develop this aspect of Jordan's heritage. It was in the homes of Iranians that I first became aware of the seeds of discontent that would develop into full-blown revolution just 3 years later. I was more fortunate than many foreigners in Tehran because I had family friends in the city, all of whom were very kind and hospitable. At dinners with Cyrus Hani, a prominent lawyer and author of several books on Iran, and members of the extensive Farman Farmayan family, I met artists, actors, and leading intellectuals, as well as government officials, and was exposed to differing perspectives on culture, politics, and social issues. Many of the young professionals I met supported the direction in which the country was moving. One of the goals of the White Revolution, the Shah had advanced in 1963, was ambitious land reform that would redistribute the vast holdings of the rich few to the many rural poor. The Shah had also championed women's rights. While I was living in Iran, he had placed Empress Farah in a position of enhanced authority. She put her support behind monthly gatherings of the country's best minds. In time, this group would be referred to as the Empress's think tank. In addition, his sister, Princess Ashraf, was serving as Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. I observed these developments with interest. As a young professional, I was intrigued by the special challenges facing women in their public and private lives, particularly highly visible and active women like the Shabanu, who so often seemed to draw fire because of opposition to their husbands and for the failings of their society. Despite these progressive goals, my friends were concerned that Iran was quickly becoming a heavy-handed police state. Savak, the Shah's secret police, was beginning to clamp down on any perceived threat to the regime, and I would meet people who were hesitant to say anything that might in any way be construed as critical. One popular employee at Llewellyn Davis, a young Iranian architect, was summarily picked up off the street by Savak and taken off for interrogation. We were not sure whether we would see him again, but he returned the next day, badly shaken. Another morning, during a company meeting, Project Director Jacqueline Robertson passed a note over his desk for us to read. It indicated that our offices were bugged and that we should be on guard at every moment. The warning was indicative of a growing restiveness. Conversations began to focus on the government and the image of the Shah and his family. In addition to the prominent and controversial Princess Ashraf, the Shah's wife was a convenient target. One story described her visit to a poor section of Tehran. Evidently, just prior to her arrival, the city's mayor had the street paved over and arranged a complete facelift for that part of town. This sparked a great deal of criticism, although most guests at the table, when pressed, acknowledged that the Empress probably was completely unaware that the mayor had whitewashed the situation to make it appear less desperate than it really was. I learned about public reaction to the 1974 Shiraz Festival. The aim of the Shiraz Festival was perfectly commendable, to spark cross-pollination between Iran and the rest of the world through a program that reflected the latest trends in theater and the performing arts. Unfortunately, this approach backfired badly. A French theater company staged the musical Hair, which had shocked Western audiences at the time because of its nudity. Needless to say, it had a far more jarring effect in an Islamic culture. There were other, more substantive causes for the growing feeling of unrest. For one thing, the oil money that had started pouring into Iran in 1973, after the Third Arab-Israeli War and the Arab oil embargo ended, was upsetting the social structure and threatening the country's cultural equilibrium. one could not miss the jolting juxtaposition of conservative and progressive. This incongruous mix was acceptable for the adaptable young middle class, but it was taking place in a society that also had strong conservative and religious underpinnings. Huge economic gaps were growing between different segments of the society. In the rural areas outside Tehran, people lived very simply, yet perhaps better than those in Tehran's growing slum areas, which often had unpaved roads, lacked electricity or sanitation, and offered the unskilled poor no way of bettering their lot. The Shah had instituted an ambitious program to eradicate illiteracy, but many of the poor had no education save what they learned at the madrasas or religious schools. Just as the government and the Shah were trying to close those gaps, they grew wider. The new oil wealth appeared to be increasingly and conspicuously concentrated in a small segment of the population. After coming to know the city and its people, I became quite disturbed by the destructive environmental and social impact I imagined the mammoth Shahistan Pahlavi project would have on the only remaining green lung in the city's rapidly growing urban sprawl. Surrounded on three sides by mountains, Tehran was a virtual trap for pollution from refineries, car exhaust, and factories. The jubes, open canals lining the edges of the streets throughout the city, carried rainwater mixed with garbage and sewage across the city, north to south. Traffic gridlocked certain sections of the city for hours. It was alarming to watch the deterioration of Tehran at the hands of rapid industrialization, especially since what had drawn me to the country was its extraordinary beauty. Living in Tehran, I also became aware of the depth of religious fervor among the Shia branch of Islam, which is centered in Iran. I learned that the major difference between the Shia and Sunni branches of Islam is the issue of the right of succession from the Prophet Muhammad. When the Prophet died in A.D. 632, a majority of his followers believed that the Prophet's father-in-law, Abu Bakr, should be their spiritual leader. Another group believed that his rightful successor was his cousin and son-in-law, Ali. The latter group eventually formed the Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, and persisted in their belief that only Ali, his male heirs, or the members of the Prophet's household, could be the rightful spiritual leader, or caliph, of Islam. However, the Sunni Muslims, who greatly outnumbered them, chose the caliph on merit, by consensus. Despite the gulf between these two branches of Islam, they both viewed the Hashemites as spiritual leaders. The rift between Shiites and Sunnis escalated into violence in A.D. 680. After Imam Ali died, his son, Imam Hussein, received word in Mecca that the self-proclaimed new Umayyad caliph in Damascus was corrupt and a drunkard, and was not fit to be the spiritual leader of the Muslim world. Despite warnings from his advisers, Imam Hussein left the Hejaz, a region on the western coast of the Arabian Peninsula, with his family and a small army, to challenge the spiritually corrupt caliph. In the bloody confrontation that followed, Imam Hussein was ambushed and murdered with 70 of his followers and family at Karbala in southern Iraq. By giving his life for Islam, Hussein became a shahid, or martyr, central to the Shiite identity as oppressed and persecuted, and Karbala, where he is buried, became a holy place of pilgrimage. Since then, the story of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein has played a key role in Shia religious thought and ritual, which also includes the staging of Shia Muslim passion plays that recount that tragic day in Imam Hussein's life to large crowds on the day of Ashura. I was in Tehran during Ashura in 1976, and I shall never forget it. Early one morning, alone in my apartment, I heard a strange sound, loud, swelling, and completely unrecognizable. It grew louder and louder, building to a roar. Looking out the window, I saw a procession of perhaps 50 men walking through the streets, flailing their bloodied bodies with chains. The sight was terrible and transfixing. At the time I had no idea what I was seeing and hearing. I learned later from Iranian friends that the self-flagellation is an expression of grief and shared suffering with Imam Hussein, whose infant son had been murdered in his arms and whose head had been cut off and paraded about on the point of a spear. The same zeal that the Shiites brought to their religion was also being channeled into politics. The Shiite scholars in the holy city of Qom, who had opposed the Shah's reforms from the beginning, demonized the Western influences that were permeating the culture. The Shah's land reforms were communist, they insisted, and the inclusion of women and non-Muslim minorities in the vote was anti-Islam. Riots had broken out in Qom in 1963, and the army had suppressed them, silencing or exiling the scholars, including the fiery Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. The growing turmoil eventually affected our Llewellyn Davis office. When two Americans were shot quite close to the residence of Jacqueline Robertson, we were advised to continually change our routes to the office and the times we normally traveled them. By early in the summer of 1976, the project staff began leaving. Concern for our safety was growing, and there was a professional reason to close the operation down as well. Now that our preliminary work was done, the next stages would take place in London, where production drawings were being created, and in New York, where architects would begin to create models. Because I was the last one hired, and the lowest on the totem pole professionally, I was one of the last employees to leave. When it was my turn, regretfully, to leave Iran, I flew to Jordan for my first brief visit there, and then on to New York. My urban planning work in Tehran had exposed me to the social and cultural fabric of a major Middle Eastern Islamic country, and made me aware of a fundamental lack of understanding in the West, especially in the United States, of Middle Eastern culture and the Muslim faith. These experiences reignited my interest in journalism, since forging an understanding between cultures now seemed even more urgent than urban planning. On my trip back to the United States, I decided to contact CBS, PBS, and other media organizations about possible jobs, and I also decided to apply to Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. I hoped that I could make a difference in a part of the world that was beginning to mean so much to me. Chapter 4. An Audience with the King. "Oh, do come in with us," Marietta urged in her typically persuasive manner. Marietta Tree, the civil rights activist and former U.S. representative to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, was an old friend of my father's, and the two of them were passing through Amman on their way to Beirut. Thinking that Marietta and King Hussein would enjoy meeting each other, my father had requested an audience with the king. Any minute now that meeting would be taking place. "No, no," I protested vehemently, "the arrangement is for you, not me." 8 months earlier, I had agreed to temporarily work for my father's aviation company in Jordan, Arab Air Services, which provided aviation design, engineering, and technical support to countries throughout the Middle East. My father's manager had taken ill, and I was covering for him until his return. As I was making arrangements to return to Amman, I was shocked to learn that Queen Alia, whom I had met only months before at the Amman airport, had been killed in a helicopter crash. In my first weeks traveling about the city, I would occasionally catch sight of a photo of the late queen pasted on the rear window of a car and be moved to tears by the image of such a young life lost and mourned. The director of my father's office had returned to work by mid-1977, but I had stayed on to help him for a while, at the same time conducting research for the Pan-Arab Aviation University in several Arab capitals. I had been preparing to leave the country when Ali Ghandour approached me with an intriguing job offer: to head a department he was creating within the Jordanian airline to coordinate planning, design, and maintenance of all the airline's facilities in Jordan and throughout the world. As fate would have it, the very next day I received my acceptance letter from Columbia's journalism school. I weighed my options. Here, finally, was the opportunity to pursue the career in journalism I wanted. But here also was the totally unexpected opportunity to take my architectural and planning training and apply it in a meaningful way. I felt ridiculously underqualified for the position Alejandro was offering me, but I could not resist the challenge. I had not mentioned to Marietta or my father the fleeting encounters I had had with the king, usually at the Amman airport, since moving to Jordan. While working, I was often out at the airport on one errand or another. I remember speeding there one day in my rented black VW Golf to pass on a letter to a colleague who was departing for the United States. I arrived, breathless, left my car engine running, and dashed onto the tarmac. The plane had only a couple of minutes before takeoff. A huge crowd of mechanics and men in gray suits had lodged themselves by the wing of the plane in an area that blocked my access. I broke through the group and nearly careened into King Hussein. "Your Majesty," I gasped, feeling a warm blush cover my face. He smiled. "How are you?" he asked. "Why don't I see more of you?" It was as if we were old friends. I blurted out something incoherent and excused myself to hand off the letter. Afterward, I drove to my friend Meliha's office at the airport's Civil Aviation Training Center. "You won't believe what just happened to me," I began, and then gave her a description of my excruciatingly awkward performance at the airport. On another occasion, Cyrus Vance, who had recently been appointed U.S. Secretary of State by President Jimmy Carter, visited Jordan soon after I started working there. Knowing of my interest in a career in journalism, members of the press corps invited me to join them for Vance's press conference with King Hussein. The press bus drove us through a deep fog up the winding road to the royal residence, Hashimiya Palace. When Cyrus Vance, one of my family's oldest friends, saw me standing among the journalists, he walked over to greet me, causing everyone in the room to turn and stare at me. It did not help that King Hussein then called out to me as I tried to shrink back into the crowd. Marietta and my father continued to insist I join them in the royal audience, while I continued to resist. I was relieved when Yanal Hikmat, the chief of protocol, arrived to escort them from the sitting room into the king's office chambers at the Diwan, as Jordan's royal court is called. My plan was to leave and meet them later at the hotel, but no sooner had they been ushered into the meeting than Yanal returned and asked me to join the group. I knew Yanal through mutual friends, so I felt comfortable telling him that I did not want to intrude on the meeting. He quickly overruled me. "The king requests your presence," he told me, putting emphasis on the word king. I slipped into the meeting as unobtrusively as possible. At the end of the audience, the king turned to me and asked if I might be able to visit his residence, Hashimiya, to take a look at some of the problems he was having with the construction of the sprawling palace complex. The next thing I knew, we had a lunch appointment for the next day. "Hash 12:30," reads my diary entry for April 7. What it does not say is that I did not get home until 7:30 that evening. When I arrived at Hashimiya, the king warmly welcomed me at the door in a leather jacket and open-necked shirt. He was talkative and relaxed as we sat down for lunch, after which we made a tour of the palace. It is fair to say it was in disastrous shape. Hashimiya had been built quickly and sloppily, and it showed. The roof leaked so badly that when it rained, water poured through the light fixtures into the living spaces. The heating, electricity, and plumbing all had abundant glitches that needed fixing. The king asked me if I could take responsibility for the work, and looked surprised when I told him that I was not qualified for the job. As I would later learn, people in positions like the king's are usually the last to be given an accurate assessment of problematic situations. Most people might assure the king of their ability to accomplish whatever he wanted, regardless of their competence or experience, but I did not want to misrepresent my capabilities with him, of all people. Someone in his position should have the best possible help. The most I can do is try to help you identify what company could provide the kind of expertise you need, I told him. As I prepared to leave the palace, the king asked if he might introduce his three younger children to me. Prince Ali, who was then 2 years old, Princess Haya, who was three, and 5-year-old Abir, a Palestinian girl that the king's third wife, Alia, had brought into the palace after the child's mother was killed by a plane crash at her refugee camp near the Amman airport. Then the king suggested that we visit the royal stables, home to desert-bred Arabian horses whose pedigrees stretched back through hundreds of years. We drove to the stables, officially known as the Royal Jordanian State Stud, with the security motorcade that escorted the king everywhere. The horses, which the Bedouin call drinkers of the wind, were extraordinarily graceful. They seemed to float above the ground as they trotted around the paddock. I had seen Arabian horses in the United States, but here, in their home, they struck me as even more beautiful. Arabs take great pride in their horses, with the distinctive Arabian dish between their wide-set eyes, their small pointed ears, their thick manes and tails, and short backbones, one vertebra less than other breeds, to better traverse rough country and sandy deserts. Many of the horses we saw that afternoon were descended from those ridden by the Hashemites during the Great Arab Revolt, the struggle led by Sharif Hussein of Mecca for independence from the Ottoman Empire. Emir Abdullah, Sharif Hussein's son and King Hussein's grandfather, rode his favorite mare, Johara, Jewel, on the day he and the other fighters besieged Medina. The king knew all the horses by name, and loved to show visitors the stud, which he considered a point of Jordanian pride, especially since so many of the great horse-breeding tribes are Jordanian. Since 1960, a Spanish couple, Santiago and Ursula Lopez, had run the stables, but the king had recently handed over responsibility to his eldest daughter, Princess Alia, who was deeply involved in the breeding of these horses, carefully developing the stock to improve bloodlines while preserving the horse's desert pedigree. Under her direction, the stud has distinguished itself in regional and international competitions. Just as we were about to leave, an extraordinary vehicle pulled up. It was a large convertible, a bright blue Excalibur, a recent gift to King Hussein from a Gulf prince. The king suggested that I drive myself home in it, with him in the passenger seat. I tried to refuse, but I could tell that the king thought it would be a great lark. So I offered a compromise. I told him that I would drive home, but in a less flashy car. I could not believe what was happening. I was driving the king of Jordan through the streets of Amman, surrounded by security vehicles, with people on the street craning for a look as the royal motorcade passed by. I felt very self-conscious, but the king seemed to revel in the spontaneity of the moment. I would soon discover that Hussein loved to create surprises. And he loved to make me blush. It was well into my marriage before I was able to control my blushing in the face of his teasing. I, on the other hand, was counting the streets until I could get to my apartment and flee inside. I kept my experiences at Hashemiya to myself, and I did not tell anyone about the telephone calls the king made to me the next day. I had lived in Jordan long enough to know that his every word, every move, every personal encounter was constantly analyzed and often misinterpreted or exaggerated. Interest in the king's private life was meteoric at the time. At 41 years old, he was once again a very eligible bachelor, and there was constant speculation about who might be his next wife. Names were being traded around the Amman dinner circuit, every source purporting inside knowledge. I was flattered, of course, that such a distinguished and accomplished man seemed to enjoy our conversations so much, I was only 26 at the time. However, the king was known for his generosity of spirit and concern for everyone living in or just passing through Jordan. Much later he would tell me that he had seen something special in my eyes during the audience at the Diwan, and that he had fallen in love at that moment. I had made some wonderful friends during my stay in Amman. Meliha Azar, a teacher in the civil aviation school, Fatina Asfour, who was running her family's match factory, Rami Khoury, the young editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times, and Amer Salti, a banker who was a member of a group I occasionally joined for tennis and who was married to an American, Rebecca. I also spent time with Khalid Shoman, deputy chairman and the son of the founder of the most prominent Arab bank, and his wife, Suha, an artist. Amman was a very small town, I quickly discovered, and almost everyone seemed to know each other. I also met my friends' families, which further extended my social circle. At the time, most entertaining in Jordan took place within a family context, and my friends' families were always warm and welcoming. I treasured their invitations to dinner. Those family meals were the best I had in Jordan, in terms of both the food and the company. Fatina's mother, a particularly good cook, taught me how to prepare my favorite dishes in the family kitchen. Bamye, which was okra, ful, which were fava beans, and fasulye, green beans and tomato sauce, which I would go home and prepare in my little apartment. The rest of the time I was usually on my own. I did not want to overextend my welcome by inviting myself too often to dinner, despite their open invitations, and the fact that I was often very lonely. It did not help that I had to walk a mile or so to the Intercontinental Hotel just to place long-distance calls home. Jordanian families are very close, and I envied them that. Their households seemed so different from my own families, and indeed from many of the families I knew in the West. Arab culture stresses interdependence. In Jordan, children my age, both sons and daughters, did not go off to live on their own, but stayed home until they married. So they always had each other for company, supervision, and security. My friends, the Asfours, had 7 daughters. With that many children, they were a world unto themselves. They were not desperately driven by material or social needs, because they had everything they needed within their own family. I enjoyed every visit to their home for dinner, where I was welcomed as one of their own. Jordan is quite a melting pot. For thousands of years it has been at the crossroads of the Middle East, serving as a vital communication and trading link between states and empires in the region and beyond. In antiquity, it was assimilated into the empires of Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Rome, Byzantium, and Persia. The scope of that cross-pollination can be seen in many of the large established families of Amman. They reflect the 3 main demographic groups in the country. The traditionally semi-nomadic Bedouin, who now have largely settled in urban areas. Families who came to the young country of Jordan in the first half of the 20th century from neighboring lands, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and Saudi Arabia, and the residents of numerous towns, villages, and agricultural hamlets whose ancestors had practiced a settled lifestyle for centuries, even millennia in some cases. The long tradition of these settled town and village folk is most easily identifiable today at antiquities sites. The unbroken human and architectural legacy of the settlements is of farmers, traders, and craftsmen and women who lived near reliable water sources, farmed the land, and kept herds of animals, communicated locally and regionally across old-as-time trade routes, and provided the strong sense of local cultural identity. In towns such as Kerak, Madaba, Irbid, Azrak, Husn, Ajlun, Anjara, Man, Aqaba, and many others that would coalesce into the Jordanian identity in the 20th century. Jordan also provided refuge over hundreds of years for many ethnic minorities fleeing political persecution and violence. Among those were the Circassians, a small but influential community of non-Arab Sunni Muslims and former refugees from oppression in their homeland in the Caucasus region in Central Asia. An ancient race, consisting of 12 tribes, the Circassians fought the Russians for 100 years, from 1764 to 1864, losing almost half of their population. The superpowers at the time, Turkey and Russia, together forced the migration of the remaining population to 3 areas in the Ottoman Empire: Turkey, Syria, and Jordan. The first Circassians arrived in 1878, settling first in the Roman ruins at Amman, uninhabited since Roman times, and then spreading to several nearby sites. 4 decades later, they welcomed King Abdullah to Jordan and instantly backed his regime. After the creation of Transjordan in 1921, the Circassians were stalwarts of the army and the government. The king's honor guard was made up of these typically tall, fair-skinned men, and at least one of my friends, Yanal Hikmat, chief of protocol at the royal court, was a Circassian as well. Then there were the Chechens, also Muslims from the Caucasus, who had fled Russian expansion in the 1890s and found a home.